corrupt Mexican presence we've had in 80 years, what could he do other than making Mexico, you know, a well-functioning country and a true democracy, capitalistic, which would take many, many decades? What could he do in the short run to help us out?
I think there's always the carrot and stick of foreign aid. We're giving foreign aid to Mexico. You can pull back on that. You can simply talk tougher with Vicente Fox.
But what could he do? Could he have troops on the border himself? I mean, what are you asking him to do?
The president, I'd withdraw some of the foreign aid that we're giving them and some of the trade advantages that we're giving them.
No, I understand that. My question is, what should the president ask Mr. Fox to do? What can he do?
Oh, Vicente Fox.
Yes, exactly.
Well, he has to get, first of all, he can come out and speak to his own people. And he can tell them
Don't cross the border?
Exactly.
I think that'll help?
Well, to the extent that
the United States.
To the extent that there is a bully pulpit in the Mexican government, Vicente Fox ought to use it. Secondly, they ought to be taking pride in their own country, in their own government, in their own economy, in their own jobs, in their own culture, and stay in their own country.
Tom, that's so easy to say. I mean, you should tell them not to come over, and they should take pride in their culture.
Well, look, Mark, you got to begin.
They got a much poorer economy than we do. We have lots of jobs here. We know why people are crossing the border.
Of course we have a lot of jobs here because we're the greatest country in the world, and it was not because somebody just snapped their fingers and happened. It's because great leaders got up and spoke to the American people, people who are ingenious in our country, built it, and that's what they have to do in Mexico.
So when Fox tells people don't go to the United States, take pride in your culture, that's going to stop illegal immigrants.
It is a place to begin, Mark.
All right, what else should he do?
I would say that that he has to get control over his own police force, his own immigration security, and he has to help clamp down on that. I know you make light of it, but the fact of the matter is Vicente Fox is encouraging his own citizens to go across the border. They have printed pamphlets. They have printed brochures. They have told their people. They have lightened up on their security forces. They are encouraging Mexicans to go across the border into the United States and get jobs send money back to their
family. I'm not a huge defender of Vicente Fox, but my understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong, that what these pamphlets are basically saying, if you're in the desert, for several hours at a time, and we know most of them cross into Arizona where there's this very fierce desert, don't get dehydrated. I mean, they're not really telling them, go cross the border and get American jobs, are they?
Yes, they are.
They are.
They are. They're saying, go across the border, take water, and don't get dehydrated. Here's where you cross. Here's how you cross.
Here's where you cross. The Mexican government is telling them where to cross.
Here's what to say if you're contacted by a police officer or a border official. Here's how to get a job. Here are the people to see in the United States. The Mexican government is wholly irresponsible in this area, and they are not being a friend to the United States of America.
I mean, Mexican businessmen, the coyotes, as they call them, the people who are bringing the people across the border, no question, they're doing all of that stuff. Is Vicente Fox actually telling people where to get jobs in the United States and who to contact and stuff like that? I mean,
I believe his government is facilitating it, Mark. Sure it is. Hmm. And this is a guy who, when President Bush was elected, the first state dinner that the Bush administration held was in honor of Vicente Fox. This is a guy who claims to have a great relationship, both personal and political, with President Bush, going back to their days as governors on the border.
Right.
And he is completely exploiting his relationship with President Bush. He has not been a responsible partner in this relationship, and I think you ought to be taken to task for
it. Okay, but clearly the problem is greater than Vicente Fox, as I'm sure you would agree.
It is.
What is the Freedom Alliance's plan? You get to write the legislation. You get to decide it all, put it in Congress. House and Senate and President magically pass it. What would your legislation be?
Well, first of all, you have to get control of the borders. I would begin by building a fence. I would go around and round up those that we know are here illegally, send them back to their own country.
5 million, 10 million, 12 million.
As many as you can round up and send back. I think you have to work with American businesses and get them to stop hiring illegals.
Would you punish them? Fines? Even criminal penalties for an employer that knowingly hires an illegal immigrant?
Sure. They're breaking the law.
How about jail sentences? You okay with that?
I'd start with fines and see how it works.
The interesting thing is we have fines. I think you know this. There are fines on the books for employers who hire illegals, but it hasn't been enforced. I saw a recent study. Since 1997, fines have gone down 70%. 70% since 97, and I think we all agree the problem is greater today than it was since 97. Why do you think the Bush administration, who after all controls enforcement, why aren't they enforcing this pre-existing law? I'm not saying we don't need tougher laws. They're not even enforcing the laws that are there.
Well, Mark, the problem goes back, it precedes the Bush administration. It goes back to the Clinton administration.
But it's down 70%.
Even the first Bush administration. But it is going down, and I think that... I think that one of the problems is that the business community is putting an awful lot of pressure on the Bush administration to allow the illegals to come in. I mean, look, they are illegals. You have to understand that. If you ran through a red light when you were coming to the interview here this evening, and the policeman pulls you over, would you say, "Ah, come on, you know everybody's doing it. What's the big deal?"
Some people say that, and some people get off.
But they're going to get a ticket.
Right.
And when you break the law, you ought to pay the price.
But here's the heart of the question. You know, they're going to get a ticket. The question is, who really is at fault here? I mean, who's the? I understand, you understand the economic implications. There are people just trying to get into America, just trying to get a job. The question, I think, at the end of the day is, who is it that needs to be punished? You know, is it the illegal immigrant or the business community or both? I'm told we have someone on the line. It is from Fairfax. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi. I just wanted to call in about the immigration issue.
Yes.
Because when I married my husband, he was actually illegal. And before I met him and before I sort of got involved in it, I was actually kind of more on the side of that idea that, okay, they've broken the law. They should pay for that breaking the law. All right? But now it's become a lot more personal. And so it's a very difficult issue, and I understand that. Why can't we do a little of both? Why can't we increase border security, which I'm for, as well as making it easier for people who want to come into the country and work, who are outside the country, to come in and work? I mean, we still need the work. We still need the people to come in, because our society is training the Americans now to believe that these sort of jobs like construction and those the more manual jobs are bad. I mean, look at the commercials we have.
You know, John McCain and Senator Ted Kennedy have a bill that just got through the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it may well be the legislation that gets through. I don't know that Bush would veto it, but their bill takes what they would consider to be a middle course. They definitely do the border security. In fact, all the bills do border security. Frist's bill, McCain's bill, the House bill, and the President, they all insist on border security. Actually, that's the one issue I think that nobody disagrees on. But what they also do is they allow, after people have paid fines and been in this country for 6 years and, you know, paid taxes and all of that, and then they have to wait another 5 years, after 11 years, they can legally become a citizen. Some people are deriding this as amnesty, but it seems to me this is a middle position. You agree?
Mark, I think I'd put it more in the column of amnesty. I think if they've come over illegally, there has to be a price to pay. I understand the lure of this country. I understand why people want to come here, and that is why we have a Statue of Liberty. That is why we're an open society. It is part of what makes us great. But part of what makes us great is because your parents and my parents came here legally. They worked. They went through the system. They stood in line. They came here fairly and squarely. And now people are trying to break that system, and it's not right.
But maybe part of our problem is legal immigration. I mean, I've seen the laws. I used to work in Congress. They're a mess. I mean, you get so many people from Ireland and so many from India, and they have to follow these obligations and these other obligations. I mean, it's this morass of laws. It's very hard, as I'm sure you know, to become a legal immigrant of the United States. Let me suggest to you that in Europe they do something different. In Europe, they have illegal immigrants too, but they're not so much strict on the borders. Maybe they should be. But they're strict at the employer level. If you're an American, you try to work in Europe and you're caught, you're not only immediately fired, but the employer is sanctioned heavily. What if we were to do this? What if we were to make the employer pay three times the wages to the government as a penalty for every illegal they're caught and hired, and possibly criminal sanctions for more intentional violations?
I have no problem with cracking down on employers who are hiring illegals, but that alone won't solve the problem. As I started out saying, this really is a national security issue as well, and we have to know who is coming over those borders and what they're carrying with them.
Well, that I certainly agree. Let's go to Carl from Centerville. Carl, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, how are you doing? I didn't even get thought I could get through. But listen, I'm an immigrant myself. Came to the United States 27 years ago from Germany. I know many Latinos in this country that just want to work. They just want to do anything else. They want to have a family, want to have build a home. And, you know, the thing is that we should accept people that really want to come in legally, and we should stop the illegal immigration. I agree with you. On the other hand, we have to, like you said, if you don't have any control and we have all these people coming across the border, how can we control it?
Carl, thank you for your call. I saw a study by the Department of Homeland Security that says if we were to deport even 90%, which doesn't take care of all the 10 to 12 million estimated legal immigrants in this country, it would still leave at least a million. It would cost some $41 billion to do that. These are people, they want to come in. I agree they broke the law. I agree they should be punished. But what the McCain-Kennedy bill does is it punishes them, but it gives them a way to work within the system. You know, what Carl's talking about, how do we actually do this?
Look, Mark, what, I think one of the important things that we have to get past here is this nonsense that, you know, everybody who's crossing the border is, well, they just want to come over and work, and they're really
nice guys,
and they're swell fellows.
Come on, it's 90%
of
them.
No, it's not. You go and you talk to the people in Douglas, Arizona, and other cities across the southwest border, and these residents will tell you that their homes have been invaded, their land has been trampled, their livestock has been killed, their lives have been destroyed, their personal property has been destroyed.
These are people right on the border.
These are people who live on the border
right.
or
people
near
people are crossing
it.
The border and, to get into this country, and I'm sure they do trample.
And are these people who are being given amnesty by some of these bills in Congress, are they really paying the price to society for the crimes they committed to those residents who live along the border? I don't think so.
We have to take a break. Folks, if you want to join in this discussion, you always can. It's easy to do. Just pick up the phone and dial 888-488-MARK. That's my name, M-A-R-K, 888-488-MARK. You can join in this discussion. We will talk about tax day as well when we come back right after this.
They came from every corner of the country. From small towns and big cities. But they all shared one thing in common. They belonged to a family called Marines. A tough and determined few. Dedicated to protecting everything we hold sacred. And still, they come. Celebrate the history of those proud few who have earned the title Marine.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest is Tom Kilgannon. He is the president of the Freedom Alliance, and we're discussing immigration, all the various immigration plans to help illegal immigrants, to push them out of the country, to find out what should be done about them. There's the presidents, there's various ones in Congress, and Tom and I have our own ideas, and so do you. And we want to hear from you. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. Later on in the hour, we're going to have Pete Sepp, Vice President of the National Taxpayers Union, to talk about that deadly day around the corner, April 15th, what taxes you have to pay, where they're going, what taxes could or should be cut, or maybe even increased, and frankly, runaway spending right here in Washington. But let's continue this discussion on illegal immigration. I want to talk about the president's plan.
Okay.
Because I got real problems with it. I want to know if you do too. The president's plan, as I understand it, is he brings in the people that are already here, illegals. He lets them stay, the ones that broke the law, but he doesn't let them become citizens. Basically, they're permanent guest workers. He's going to allow them to be here, but they have to work and be a guest worker, and they can never become citizens. And so if, for example, they get below minimum wage, they can't complain. They'll be deported. If they're mistreated on the job and the employer violates worker and health safety laws, How can they complain? They'll be deported. It seems to me this will undercut American labor that's worked very hard to get minimum wages, worker safety standards. The other thing it does, I think, is it creates a permanent underclass, much like they have in Europe right now with their guest worker programs. I got real problems with it. What's your view?
So let me get this straight. We are now worrying about worker safety for those who illegally crossed the border and came in, traversed the desert, and fought dehydration and wild animals and everything else.
No, Tom, you're missing my point. We're worried about American citizens.
But they're not American citizens.
But you missed my point. If you have an employer and he can hire two people, he can hire an American citizen who insists on minimum wages and worker safety standards, mm-hmm. or he can hire an illegal who is scared to death of being deported and is willing to work for much less and to work under unsafe conditions, he'll hire the illegal, because the illegal, he can mistreat, he has basically a permanent slave there,
okay.
and the American job will
loses
be pushed
that.
Out. That's my point.
Mark, the American is losing out regardless of what should be done, and regardless of whose plan you take. So I think the president has a tough position here. He has to really try and thread the needle between those who want tougher border security
Everyone wants tougher border security. We can disagree on what to do with the illegals.
You have tough border security, and then you have tough border security, and I'd go with Tom Tancredo over Arlen Specter on that. But I don't think the president has been tough enough on this issue, and it's showing in his poll numbers. It's showing in the erosion of support he has experienced over the last several months.
Let me go to Elena from Alexandria. Elena, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
This is my point. I'm also immigrant. A lot of people are in this country is immigrant. But the difference is we don't make a different language. We don't isolate ourselves. We associate with American because we learn English. We speak English. And the problem is not being illegal immigrant. But they want to be their language spoken. In fact, some places you don't even get a job if you don't speak Spanish. And they isolate themselves. They have a group, unless you are Spanish, da-da-da-da-da. That is the problem.
I'll tell you something, Elena. I actually disagree with you. Tom may very well agree with you, and I'll give him a chance. I don't think that particularly is the problem. I think if you look throughout American history, when the Germans came in the 1840s and the Irish in the 1880s and the Jews and Italians at the turn of the century on through the Latinos today, people have said they keep to themselves, they keep their own culture, they're not assimilating, and we find that in a generation, people do assimilate. My impression of Latinos in the United States is, yes, immigrants, and not just Latinos, whether they're Russian or German or whatever, immigrants themselves have some difficulty learning English and adjusting to the culture. But by the time they have people born in the United States, those kids get it. They speak fluent English. So my problem, I don't think it's a cultural problem here. I mean, that's all you can make against legal immigrants as well as illegal immigrants.
You can, but it is a problem. Assimilation is very much a problem. And I don't think they're coming in. They're not. It's about a lot more than language. Language is a part of it, but you have to learn the Constitution. You have
to become a citizen.
You have to.
Sure.
You have to become a citizen, and that's just more than passing a test. You have to really become a part. You have to stand up for America. You have to take a vow to protect and defend America.
Sure.
And that is not being done. And we see that in these rallies that were held these last several weeks. Is the Mexican flag is being brought out? It is being raised.
So what, Tom?
So what?
Ever seen a St. Patrick's Day parade? I've seen a lot of Irish flags. I mean, come
and
on.
And Irish as
Irish.
As
American,
somebody
Mexican
who is
American.
As somebody of Irish descent, the Irish have done an awful lot for this country.
Of course they have, and Mexican Americans have too. I mean, the difference is the Irish came here in the 1840s and the 1880s.
They've had
a lot more time to assimilate.
You don't see masses of illegal Irishmen, you know, hoarding City Hall and carrying...
But you probably did in the 1880s, right?
No, I don't think so. And carrying the Irish flag over the American flag. In other words, they came to this country for a better opportunity, and they worked for it, they fought for it, they built it, and then they became active in politics.
You know, it's interesting. There's so many different issues here. One is the cultural nativist issue, which I have to admit I don't have much sympathy for, because I think every generation of immigrants, legal or illegal, takes some time to assimilate, but one generation later, They're always there. And I think that's true in American history. But then there's this other economic issue where I do have more sympathy with American workers whose real wages are falling. They've been falling every year of the Bush administration. Union membership is down from 35% to 7%. Workers are getting a bum rap, and then you have people always coming on the bottom, lowering the cost of labor. That's where I guess my sympathy comes in to do something about illegal immigrants.
And look, you and I can find common ground in that area because I'm somebody who didn't believe that NAFTA should have been passed back in 1994. But because the idea at the time was, well, we're going to pass NAFTA, and it's going to build up Mexican factories, give Mexicans a good wage, let them have good jobs. None of that has happened. And what we see now is not only have American jobs gone overseas and American factories gone to Mexico, but now the jobs, the Mexicans are coming back to the United States and taking what jobs are left from the lower and middle class workers. And it's a real problem for American workers. And I don't think it is fair to say to Americans that, well, just go get some job retraining. That doesn't always cut it.
See, I think the reason why the president doesn't – let me ask you this before I get there. You support Tom Tancredo's bill? Is that where the Freedom Alliance comes down, that the harsh we can disagree on whether it's harsh or not, but the most difficult for the illegal immigrants? In other words, deport them all, shut the borders – very different from the president's guest worker plan or the Kennedy-McCain bill. Is that the one you support, or would you change it a bit?
I would probably support the Tancredo bill. I think Tom Tancredo has done a great job on this. And I think if you're really going to be serious about this, you've got to start and say, if you've done something illegal, we're not going to grant you amnesty or grant you some kind of get-out-of-jail-free card because you happen to successfully evade our laws. I think you've really got to get serious, set an example, and show people that things are going to be different from here on out because our national security is on the line, our economic security is on the line, and we had better get serious about this issue.
Well, here's what I find strange. If you look at all the plans, whether it's Tancredo's plan, Bill Frist's plan, which is basically just border security and doesn't deal with the immigration problem at all, the president's guest worker plan, or even the Kennedy-McCain plan, which I lean toward, none of them punish the employers, hardly at all. We can disagree on what to do with illegals. I, frankly, while I don't respect that they broke the law, I do feel sorry for some of them. I understand that while they're illegal, they're just trying to live the American dream in the way that our ancestors did, although they came legally. But it seems to me that the one thing that all the plans have in common, they don't punish the employers. And I don't think Republicans want to punish their big business allies by denying them cheap labor.
Look, I think if employers are hiring illegals, then they ought to pay a price too. I understand that it's hard to find good, competent help these days, but you have to do what you have to do, and you have to, as I said, you have to have a depth of seriousness to this when you begin, and if you've done something illegal, somebody has to be punished for that.
So why isn't Tom Tancredo, the most anti-illegal immigrant guy in Congress, why isn't he saying, all right, Walmart, you hire all these illegals, hefty fines, millions of dollars. If it puts Walmart out of business, so what? You shouldn't have broken the law. I don't hear Tom Tancredo saying that.
Well, I'll let the congressman answer him for himself.
Fair enough.
I think...
I don't hear Republicans or Democrats saying that.
I think that Mr. Tancredo has done an outstanding job of trying to put the bulk of the responsibility where it belongs, and that is with the Mexicans who are coming across and breaking the law at the outset of this problem.
Tom, you've been a terrific guest. Coming up in the second half hour, we're going to move on to Tax Day. I'm going to have Pete Sepp, the Vice President of the National Taxpayers Union, answering your calls at 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. We'll be right back with U.S. tax policy right after this.
This is Mommy's bed. Me and Jenny were jumping on it. Mommy's gun fell on the floor. I was a cowboy. Bang, 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 bang. I said, Jenny, wake up, wake up. It's just pretend. But she wouldn't wake up.
If you give me a fish...
If you give someone a fish...
You feed them for a day.
teach someone to fish.
You feed them for a lifetime.
Give me a fish, and you'll feed me for a day. Teach me to fish, and you'll feed me for a lifetime.
Through Volunteers of America, you can help change lives in your community.
Oh, hey, mister, studied algebra in school and got a better job than I could. You take the last call.
Oh, no, mister, stuck in an entry-level job because you only learned basic math. I don't have a boss riding my butt like you do, so you take it so you can get back to your desk.
You know, I probably should, but maybe Miss AP Calculus with the $200 haircut in the big office upstairs would like a cup.
Oh, no, mister, what was your name again? Never mind, it doesn't matter. I'm too busy doing important things to care. I just came down for some sweet nectar.
You know, if my limited math abilities weren't keeping me from getting a better job, I'd quit this afternoon.
I don't blame you. But thank goodness you're stuck here because we really need someone to make the coffee.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. It is that time of the year. It's the beginning of April, and all of us have to get out all those forms. Or, you know, me, I go to TurboTax and try to let it figure it out for me. But it's not easy. And we wonder, where is all this money going? Federal, state, and local taxes. Is it going to the war in Iraq? Is it fairly paid? I mean, is it that the rich are getting a better tax deal than the poor? And what about runaway spending? Why is it that Bill Clinton, the Democrat, managed to give us a surplus while George Bush, a Republican, has given us the highest deficit in American history? To help answer these questions, I've invited Pete Sepp, the Vice President of the National Taxpayers Union. Pete, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with taxes, all right? We, of course, have to pay them in April. Is it your view taxes are too high even today?
I would think so, especially at the state and local level. That's one of the untold stories out there in the United States. Property taxes especially are taking a huge bite out of people's wallets. In fact, property taxes were the only major category of state and local tax revenue that were actually increasing during the recession of 2001. It is now the single largest source of state and local tax revenue. It's been going up by double digits in some areas of the country.
Now, of course, that's with home prices. I mean, when they go up, property taxes go up. I understand local governments can cut the tax rate, but it's sort of a natural, quiet tax increase, right?
Yes, and of course, it's an unjustified one, in my opinion, because what about people who don't want to move? What if they don't care about their house going up in value by 10-20% every year? They're not going to benefit from that increase in value, yet they're going to get taxed on that increase
in
value.
They have to take a loan out on the equity, basically.
And you also have to ask the question, if property tax collections go up 20 or 30% in a jurisdiction, does that mean it's justified? Do they need 20 or 30% more fire engines or schools or other kinds of local services when the population isn't growing that fast?
What we find, though, is that because Congress is giving less money to the states than it used to, that's really gone down over the last 10 years because they're fighting a huge budget deficit that local governments need more just to pay that back. So, to some extent, and I'm not disagreeing that property taxes have gone up, but to some extent, aren't property taxes merely filling the hole caused by the deficit caused by the Bush tax cuts of 2001?
Well, the reduction in state and local aid from the federal level explains part of the problem, but it doesn't explain all of it because state revenues as a percentage of personal income are now above 10% nationally. That is really about a percentage and a half point above what we normally see. So taxes at the state level are going up and spending is going up independently of the loss of grants and aid.
Well, let's talk about spending, because what I find interesting is that when you talk with Republicans, they love tax cuts. They never met a tax cut they didn't like. But you ask them about spending cuts, and, oh, they got to go. There's just no time. Sorry, goodbye. You, I know, want less taxes than we have.
Yes.
And I don't think you believe in massive deficits. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
All right. So you don't believe in massive deficits. You want lower taxes. Therefore, we have to cut a lot of spending.
Yes.
So I'm going to take out my list here and ask you the tough question, Pete. In order to cut spending enough to go down to a lower level of taxes, we need hundreds of billions of dollars cut. Literally, hundreds of billions of dollars. So Where's it going to come from? The war in Iraq, that's a couple hundred billion. Would you cut that?
I think that we ought to address parts of defense spending. I don't think that, for example, the Republican line, we have to hold spending down in every category but defense, is really defensible when you consider that the contracting operations of the Department of Defense have been on the GAO, the Government Accountability Office's high-risk list for waste, fraud, and abuse for the better part of 15 years. That's a danger sign that a ton of money, billions of dollars a year, in fact, is going down a rat hole just on defense contracts. That doesn't even consider all of the prioritization that needs to take place. We have not consolidated enough military bases. We're still building Cold War-era weapons systems like the F-22 fighter. Those are no longer needed in today's environment, and we ought to be shifting those priorities.
Well, Pete, I agree with you. I mean, I'd be the first one to talk about no bid contracts to Halliburton and all the wasteful military spending. But waste, as you know, is only part of it. We can't get away with it with only waste. Let me ask you specifically about the war in Iraq and maybe try to get a little separate from the question of whether it was a good war or not. Let's just ask, let's assume it was a good war, which, folks, you know I don't believe. Assume it was a good war. When you have a war, shouldn't you pay for it? What didn't we learn in Vietnam? That when Lyndon Johnson had a war, didn't want to pay for it, we were in the worst stagflation of the 1970s. They teach you in your economics classes. Why do we have the worst economy in the 1970s of any other decade? Because we spent on the war in Vietnam, and Johnson didn't raise taxes to pay for it. So let me ask you this question. Assuming we want the war in Iraq, again, I don't, but assuming we have it, shouldn't we at least raise taxes to pay for that war?
I think we have to look again at the priorities within the military budget, not just the waste, fraud, and abuse, but some of the big-ticket weapons systems. We got the ball rolling in the early part of the Bush administration when we canceled things like the Crusader artillery system and the Comanche helicopter. There's a long way to go there. I'd point out, too, that taxes normally do rise during wars, and that's something that concerns us a great deal. The first income tax was instituted temporarily by Abraham Lincoln in this country. In England, it was in response to the Napoleonic War. Even Lyndon Johnson actually pushed through a tax rate increase. It was actually a surtax on the top income tax rate. So that is a danger sign.
So what do we have to do? We have to not fight as many wars as we're fighting? Are you going to go that far and say that?
No.
No, you're not.
We do have to do some prioritization. We also have to look at the domestic side of the spending ledger, especially entitlement growth. One thing I think that the conservative caucus called the Republican Study Committee has a good idea about is controlling the growth of the Medicare prescription drug benefit, limiting it to poor people and lower income households alone.
But the president just expanded all of that with mostly Republican votes. There were a few, I mean, maybe 10-20% Republicans who voted against it. But as I recall on that bill, they didn't have enough votes. It went through the night and it was going down, and they had to twist arms and promise
the administration actively
to do that.
Yes.
And that would be 80-90% Republicans. So are you getting on them for that?
I think we said then, and we say it now, this was the most monumental fiscal mistake of a generation. The Republicans, as well as the Democrats, committed the United States to upwards of $8 trillion in future liabilities by that one vote alone. They've got to revisit it. Some Republicans who voted for it might be willing to turn this back into a targeted program for lower-income folks because conditions are different now, and a lot of them feel like they've been hoodwinked about the cost estimates behind this bill.
But, Pete, here's the problem. Okay, I agree with you. Frankly, I wouldn't do the war in Iraq, and that would be $200 billion saved. I did not support the Medicare prescription drug bill. But if you look at the way, systemically, we had spending and taxes, under Bill Clinton, we had pretty much equal. We actually had slightly more taxes than spending going out. We had a surplus. Hadn't been seen in 40 years, an amazing thing in American history. We may not see it again. It's kind of like the unicorn, I don't know, the dodo bird. But we actually had more money coming in than money going out. When George Bush cut taxes in 2001, as you well know, this was before September 11th. This was before any question of going to war in Iraq. He may have had the idea, but it wasn't on the books. Before the Medicare prescription drug benefit, and immediately we went into deficit. In other words, when he cut taxes in 2001, you can't blame it on these new programs, which I agree are wrong. You got to cut some meat, don't you? Not just some fat. I mean, where do you cut it to go down? If you supported the Bush tax cuts, as I'm sure you did, where would you cut spending?
Well, One thing I think in the Republican Study Committee's plan that's worth exploring is consolidating and shrinking the size of the Departments of Energy, the Departments of Homeland Security even, taking a look at the Departments of Labor and Commerce as well. Commerce, for example, has been a great source of corporate welfare over the years, giving grants to Sunkist to advertise products overseas. That's actually
agriculture. You're selling like a Democrat now.
That's actually Agriculture Department. I should correct myself. But they do really give other kinds
of subsidies.
And that's an area to start. I think we ought to be able to find common ground, for example, with the Democratic Blue Dog Coalition in Congress. Their proposals for budget process reform and some of their budget-cutting priorities match those of the RSC.
If you want to call in, folks, it's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-MARK. You can also comment on the blog. Some of you don't want to call in, you want to write in. That's okay, too. Just go to www.radioinsidescoop.com, put your comment down, and we will get to your comments and more of taxpayer policy right after this.
Sweetheart, smoke outside now. You promised.
Okay, hon.
Sweetheart, smoke outside now. You promised.
What kind of man are you?
I'm a father.
Look here, my father was a father, and he smoked his brains out in the house.
Watch as he blows those smoke rings on my little red face.
You probably have asthma.
Asthma? Schlasma. I'm telling you, nothing's going to happen to your kids.
Don't swear when you're lying. You know very well that thousands of kids get bronchitis, ear infections, and even pneumonia from their parents' cigarette smoke. And didn't you promise your little angels you'd smoke outside?
Hey, Daddy.
Hi, Daddy.
Those little devils are just so sweet.
Do the right thing.
Please, smoke outside.
Until you can stop, go out for your kids.
Take the pledge. Call 1-800-513-1157.
Is a rite of passage, a challenge to join the elite, and if you succeed, if you can master your fear, outsmart your enemy, and never yield even to yourself, you will be changed forever. The few, the proud, the Marines.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. My guest is Pete Sepp, the Vice President of the National Taxpayers Union. April 15th is around the corner. All of us got to get together, get our number two pencils, or usually our computers these days, and get to work. And we're discussing tax policy, how much taxes we pay, how much spending we do, and, well, where is all that money going? If you want to join in the debate, it's easy to do. Pick up the phone, dial 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Now, Pete, I've been pressing you hard here because it's easy to say you want to cut taxes. But when you talk about cutting spending, someone's ox is gored. And speaking of gored ox, we can talk about agricultural subsidies,
yes,
which I think both Republicans and Democrats let go through the roof. Part of the problem, I think, is actually constitutional. Because our Constitution gives every state two senators, the South Dakota farmers get two, the North Dakota farmers get two, the New Jersey farmers aren't so much, and it's a much bigger state. What can we do politically for Republicans and Democrats to cut down on agricultural subsidies?
The key thing is for the groups out there to join together, and that's exactly what we're doing. We're enlisting allies in a farm subsidy reform coalition for the upcoming 2007 Farm Bill reauthorization. We're teaming up with Oxfam, organizations all over the political left as well as the right who are saying this is not only bad for taxpayers, it's bad for third world countries, because when we inflate the prices of our goods on the international market, actually on the domestic market, and then we send low-priced goods into the international market, well, all we're really doing is impoverishing third world farmers and preventing them from competing with us.
No question about it. One of the things that always interests me is that we give subsidies for tobacco farmers, and then tobacco kills 400,000 Americans a year. I mean, I'm not arguing to make cigarettes illegal, but do we really have to subsidize this deadly substance?
It seems a little contradictory, and there are lots of examples of that in the federal government. In agriculture subsidies alone, for example, we're paying federal subsidies to pump water into the desert so farmers can grow subsidized crops like cotton.
Right,
it makes
right.
no sense.
It doesn't make any sense. But I have to tell you, all of these things, you don't hear very much talk about it by any politician, agricultural subsidies.
Yeah.
You do find people on the left talking about corporate welfare, and you find people on the right talking about human welfare. But at the end of the day, is that enough? I mean, how low do you think taxes could actually go, and what do you think should still be provided by the government?
I think it depends on how much we as a society are willing to accept on our own versus what we want government to provide us. I think we really have to take a hard look at the entitlement program. Social Security and Medicare are the two big elephants in the room as far as federal budgeting is concerned. Education is the big elephant in the room at the state and local level. We've been pumping billions of dollars in increases a year, now even from the federal government. It's interesting, defense spending was actually outstripped by education spending during the first 6 years of the Bush administration in terms of increases. We actually spent more federal money at a higher rate on education than we did on defense. But those three topics,
clear, it's far less. I mean,
yeah, it's a lesser amount,
but
in percentage terms. And that's interesting, considering we've had the war on terror, which has a Defense Department component, and we have the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And despite that, federal education funding has been jumping by leaps and bounds.
What's interesting to me is when people complain about Social Security, is that Social Security has its own separate funding source. Now, that has been abused more than used.
Yes.
I mean, people have used Social Security taxes to fund the rest of the government and
yes.
so forth. But it seems to me that the one thing that people, you know, are paying specifically for, they know it's for Social Security has a large amount of political support in this country. The president tried to change it and ran up against a rock. I mean, that's not something that you or anyone else is going to change easily. Why is that always picked on instead of all these other things like corporate welfare and agriculture and things like that that I think left and right could come together on?
Well, it's always a matter of where do you start first? Do you go with the biggest ticket items, the ones that would get the most savings if we simply looked at them on an individual basis, or do you go with the lower hanging fruit, the ones that we might be able to achieve now but will yield less savings? I think we've got to try and concentrate on both, but we have to pick and choose which ones we can win. I don't think we're going to win the Social Security battle anytime soon, but means testing and benefit limitations will probably be forced upon a Congress 10 or 15 years from now. I think Medicare's reckoning is coming a lot sooner.
I agree with you definitely on that. Let me ask you this about not the level of taxes, but which taxes? We all know there are certain taxes the rich pay, there are certain taxes the poor pay. In fact, one of my problems with Social Security taxes and why I support a Social Security tax cut is because this is one of those taxes where the poor pay a higher percentage of their income than the rich. If you make under $80,000 or so, you pay the whole FICA, 7.5% or 15%. If you make $100,000 or $1 million or $10 million, you might pay 0.5% in Social Security taxes. It's a very regressive tax.
Yes.
I'd like to cut that, but at the same time, I want a higher estate tax, a tax that's paid by only 1% or 2% of people. These are heirs who've received hundreds of millions of dollars sometimes for doing no work on their own. I'm a lot more sympathetic for a woman holding two jobs paying her Social Security taxes than I am for an heir that's a trust fund baby. How do you think about that?
Well, I think there are many economists who would say that the estate tax in its current form can actually discourage the production of other kinds of revenue. If, for example, it reaches too low into multimillion-dollar firms even, it might actually cause the breakup of those firms, and you get a situation where you get fewer employee and income tax collections because the business no longer exists, even though you get that amount of estate tax out of the business when it's broken up.
Okay, but
sometimes
estate taxes,
it's a wash.
I mean, the Democrats have agreed to go up to about $6 million a year, which seems, you know, we could argue it should be 6 or 10. I remember, though, that Russ Feingold, when I worked in Congress, he said, you know, the Republicans want to get rid of the estate tax. So he put literally an absurd bill in there, and he said, all right, we will only do estate taxes if it's $100 million or more. This is a real bill. I think
yeah,
you may be aware
of it.
$100 million or more. The Republicans voted it down 54 to 46. Now, we may have two or three people die a year with estates that big. Why are they protecting those people at the same time as making the ordinary taxpayer pay through the nose?
I think they were trying to hold out to eliminate the tax entirely because I think the reasoning was, well, if you get rid of the estate tax entirely, you also get rid of the entire estate planning industry, which creates distortions throughout the economy. I bet now, though, they probably regret that they didn't take the deal because I think we're going to be perpetually one or two votes short of full repeal of the estate tax
but
for the time
why
being.
Why are Republicans focusing on the estate tax and not the Social Security tax? That's the heart of my question. Understanding that we all have to pay some level of taxes,
true.
You and I may disagree on the amount. Can't you and I agree that the Social Security tax, which makes the poor pay a higher percentage of their income than the rich, is a far more unfair tax than a tax that applies to 2% or less of American families? And it only applies to people who literally did not earn the money that they got.
Well, the burden certainly affects more people when you're talking about payroll taxes. And if you look at the overall tax burden, the Congressional Budget Office actually studied this. They examined excise taxes, which hit the poor very heavily, especially gasoline, tobacco, airline tickets. They examined the payroll taxes. They found that the lowest quintile, the lowest people at the income ladder, paid about 15% of their total income in taxes, but the earned income credit, that mechanism within the tax code that gives people money back through the income tax system, that offset a lot of it. So the net effect is about 8%, while the wealthiest fifth of Americans are still looking at above a 30% burden.
I actually don't think people who are poor, most of them, realize that they have that earned income tax credit.
Sometimes.
Let me go to Mike from Fairfax. Mike, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Mike, are you there on the telephone? Mike? Apparently you call. Oh, we lost you. Mike, we still got a few minutes left. I hope you'll call back. Our producers say this person called a lot of passion, but apparently we lost him. It may be... For Mike's benefit, it may be the rainstorm outside. Let me go to what you have in front of you, which is a report card. I went out to your website before the show today, National Taxpayers Union. I looked for the report card, not so much for the final result, but I want to know what you based it on. And I was sorry to see that on your website, you didn't have, like some groups do, he voted yes on this bill, no on this bill. Why isn't that up on your website?
One of the problems is, unlike other ratings which use 10, 20 key votes, we use every single roll call vote affecting taxes, spending, debt, regulation, anything that could cost taxpayers. We're talking about 370 votes last year. We're happy to offer those lists of votes for people who request them, but actually tallying up the yeas and nays for each senator and congressman, that would be a lot of data.
I still think you should put it on your website. Let's go back. Mike from Fairfax, we got you back. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks for putting me on. The estate tax is, we didn't want royalty in Europe who have the Bill Gates passing on from generation to generation. The estate tax isn't to hit the family farm. It's to hit the noblemen, the land trust and land barons, to perpetuality. That's why we have the estate tax, and that's why it should not be eliminated.
Well, Mike, I agree with you, but I Pete may not.
Well, the problem is it's not really doing anything to get rid of this so-called royal class. When you look at even Alicia Monell, okay, she was one of President Clinton's Treasury advisors. She noted in a study that people with estates above $20 million actually pay a lower effective rate than those with estates that are under $20 million.
Because they can't afford the lawyers and tax people that help them
and
avoid the tax. But maybe we just
get
rid of the
loopholes.
Well, no, but you can't just say the tax isn't working. Get rid of the loopholes, right?
You do that, and then you have the nation's charities getting on the backs of policymakers saying, you change the estate tax code, we'll be deprived of millions of dollars a year in good works.
I'd rather have a little bit less money go from, I mean, the charities can get more money from the government if you have the estate tax, because they, if that money were directly transferred to the Red Cross or anyone else, they would get more money. My problem is there are people like Anna Nicole Smith in the world who do absolutely nothing, right, and get hundred millions, well, I don't know if she did nothing, but what she did is not something that I endorse or you. I mean, why is it, this is broader than the estate tax, why is it that we seem to punish people who work and don't punish people who haven't worked? And let me just make my point a little broader, and you can respond. It's not just the estate tax. When Republicans try to cut taxes, what do they go for first? Capital gains, dividends, interest. This is all money you earn for not working, right? I got my money in the bank. I sit there. I don't work. I got my dividends. I do nothing. They want to praise the people who are lazy, and people who are actually out there working for a living, they want to punish. Can't we agree that at least as regards to income tax versus estate or capital gains or dividend or interest tax, that it's more fair to lower income taxes and increase the taxes for the people who aren't working?
Well, investment taxes aren't necessarily paid only by people who don't work. You earn the money to put the money into those investments in the first place. You watch that money grow for your retirement. There's, after all, about 50% of middle-class households now own a stock mutual fund or a 401k, some other kind of vehicle. They want to accumulate earnings in those accounts without having them taxed, since they've already been taxed once as income.
Well, I mean, I'm about to go to TurboTax and do my taxes over the next couple of weeks, and I know how it works. Capital gains,
yes,
dividends are taxed at a lower rate than,
yes,
income taxes. Now, way back in the Reagan years, no liberal,
yes,
he, they said, you know what, we're going to tax them all the same. It was 28% at that time. Don't you think that a dollar earned and a dollar earned by dividends or capital gains, interest, should all be taxed at the same rate?
We could tax it at a neutral rate, and that, of course, was the premise of the 1986 tax reform. Two rates, 15 and 28, a broader base, fewer deductions. That's kind of the plan that the President's Tax Reform Commission came up with last year, although they were a little more timid in some places. We've got six tax brackets now. They propose taking it down to three or four. I think there's a vast difference between a two-rate system and a three-rate system. It's not just a factor of one extra rate.
See, I think it's really not about the rates. What I find, what I respected about the 86 bill was as they lowered the rate, they really cut out the loopholes. And what I think you may agree with me is from 86 to today, the loopholes have just gone through the,
yes,
roof. You can get a tax loophole for buying a pen with a blue point,
yes,
that doesn't. There's an amazing amount of mess in the tax,
yes,
code. Can't we agree at least to swipe away those loopholes?
If we can lower the rates, yes, I think so.
Let me go to Eric from Fairfax. We only have a few minutes left. Make your point quick, please. Eric, you're on the Inside Scoop. Eric from Fairfax, last chance.
Yes.
There you are. Go ahead.
How are you? Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I have a question that's not particularly pertaining to estate taxes, but just taxes in general.
Go ahead.
And the financing of that, and then why the question of why do they do that.
You only got
20 seconds. The 30-year bond, hiatus of 5 years, they reintroduced it. Why did they discontinue in the first place, and this is a giveaway to the banks?
Okay. Why did they discontinue a 30-year bond?
Political pressure, probably, and the fact that there's a special interest in grain to try and get another favorable tax situation somewhere else with the bonds. And that's part of the problem we have to face here. If we had true tax reform, fewer rates, broader base, more transparency, that would take away a lot of the power of lobbyists to add these provisions back in.
And frankly, it's all the same problem. It's money in government, it's pork, it's in our tax code, it's in our spending, and I think we need to sweep the pork out of the stables, and hopefully you can do that in November 2006. That's it for today's Inside Scoop. We're going to be off for the next 2 weeks. I'm going to be in Colorado attending the Conference on World Affairs. You can go to the internet, see what panels I'll be on. But the next 2 weeks, we're going to have a very interesting panel right here, never before played anywhere in public. The University of District of Columbia, I attended a forum there. What has the Bush administration done for African Americans? It's fascinating. Check it out next week, 7 o'clock. I'm chasing a shadow.
to believe he was the same as me and you.